From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And we'll start this hour with that draft government report on climate change that was leaked to the New York Times and the Washington Post. It directly contradicts the climate change skepticism expressed by President Trump and members of his cabinet. Scientists from 13 federal agencies say in the report that it is extremely likely that more than half of the rise in temperatures in the U.S. over the past 40 years has been caused by human activity, especially by heat-trapping greenhouse gas emissions. But there are fears about how the Trump administration will handle the report. Joining us now is Stephen Mufsin, who covers energy and infrastructure for The Washington Post. Stephen, welcome.
Glad to be here.
And who wrote this report, and why do you think it's being leaked right now?
Well, the report is the work of scientists from 13 different agencies in the federal government, specialists on climate, and they've also reached out to scientists in the academic world to help them draw up this report. I think the reason why it's being leaked now is that a lot of scientists, both in and out of government, are very worried about how President Trump is going to handle scientific information, especially information about climate, about which he seems to be a tremendous skeptic, right? He dismissed it once as a hoax.
Right.
And even his cabinet members who have acknowledged some human role in climate change have said it's just hard to say how much and that the science isn't quite developed about it and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of concern about what's he going to do. And so the object of leaking the report is that it's out there. There's a benchmark. You can see what changes are made in the future if they're for political reasons or for some other reason.
Because it may be changed again, right? It's already in. It's something like fifth draft.
Right. This is the fifth draft. And there was an earlier version that's been online for quite some time. So the idea is to show exactly what was there before it got to the political people in the White House.
All right. Well, let's talk about what's in it. This report strongly links human activity to climate change, not just in the U.S., but around the world. The government scientists estimated a more than 1 degree Fahrenheit rise in global temperatures from 1951 to 2010. Talk about the significance of that.
Well, again, the significance is pinpointing it on emissions that are caused by people. And that's been a key element. You know, Rick Perry said the other day when asked on a CNBC what was the primary driver and were people the primary driver behind climate change, and he kind of wriggled out of that and said, well, it's, you know, the oceans are important and things like that. So this report definitely is trying to pinpoint, based on the science out there, pinpoints it, the climate change so far on human activity.
Mm-hmm. It also estimates that the U.S. faces a 2.5 degree Fahrenheit increase in temperatures over the next few decades, even under significantly reduced future emissions of greenhouse gases. 2.5 degrees. It doesn't sound like much. We know from studying this issue, it is a lot. Is there any plan out there that would prevent a 2.5 degree increase in temperatures?
Not really. I mean, and one of the things I've found striking covering energy and, you know, increasingly environmental issues for the Post is that we've made incredible progress in energy efficiency by the standards of the energy industry over the past 10-15 years. But it's nowhere near enough to meet the targets for climate, if you believe climate scientists. And even if you think their climate science is off by some gigantic margin of error, it's still not enough. I mean, the scope of this problem is just huge.
And the report connects climate change to extreme weather events. The European heat wave of 2003 and a heat wave in Texas in 2011. What does it say? Because scientists are often very careful to connect individual weather events to climate change.
Yeah, it's saying that these extreme events will become more extreme. That's one important thing it says. It says the type of record-setting heat we've seen in various places in the last couple of years will become the norm in the coming decades. It talks about sea levels and how much they're going to rise. It talks about the retreat of ice in the Arctic. There are many areas where it doesn't feel that it has the scientific basis to say things, but there are many other areas where this report pushes forward on the basis of new evidence that's been accumulated since the last time they did one of these reports.
So, Stephen, just in the 30 seconds we have left, when will we know if the Trump administration releases this report in full or scrubs big parts of it? Do you know when it will be coming out?
No, we really don't. And, these reports, these climate national climate assessments were created by an act of Congress back in 1990. It was supposed to come out every 4 years, and only three have come out. So Politics isn't new. Whether they just sort of pocket veto it or issue it or change it, that's remains to be seen.
That's Stephen Mufsin, who covers energy and infrastructure for The Washington Post. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, to New Jersey now, where nearly 5 years after Superstorm Sandy, thousands of residents have returned to their homes on the New Jersey shore. For most of them, that's a cause for celebration. For some, it can be the start of a new nightmare. They are people who received aid money to rebuild and are now being asked to pay that back. Joe Hernandez from Here Now contributor WHYY explains.
Imagine if your home gets damaged by a hurricane or a tornado or a flood. The government steps in and gives you some money to repair it. And then a little while later, the government returns and says, we gave you too much and we want that money back.
It's like kicking somebody when they're just starting to get back up.
Superstorm Sandy destroyed Julie Suarez's home in Little Egg Harbor Township, New Jersey. She got government aid to build a new one and moved in less than 2 years after the storm. But then she got a letter in the mail saying she had to pay back $51,000 of relief money, money she had already spent. It was about a fifth of the total government aid she received. For the public school teacher, it sounded impossible.
My car has 317,000 miles on it. I do not live high on the hog. I mean, this is not a joke. I shop at like TJ Maxx on the clearance section.
Suarez is one of hundreds of New Jersey homeowners who've been asked to pay back state or federal aid money, and the sums average in the thousands per person. So far, federal and state agencies have recouped more than $5 million from New Jerseyans impacted by Sandy. The reasons for the government asking for disaster relief aid back can vary. Sometimes it happens because a contractor repairs or rebuilds a home in ways that weren't approved by the agency, or the overall cost of construction was lower than expected. The most common reason for a repayment is what's called a duplication of benefits. That's when a homeowner simultaneously gets aid from different government agencies for the same thing. Amanda DeVecca-Rainier is the director of the New Jersey Organizing Project. She says people don't always know when they're duplicating benefits. They take whatever aid money they need to recover. So getting those repayment letters in the mail is a bit of a shock. They're mostly coming from a state program known as REM.
People have the impression that every step of the way, they've done what REM asked, they've signed the papers, they went through this thing got approved, and then they get the letter, and it just doesn't make any sense.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, and the New Jersey Department of Community Affairs, or DCA, declined interview requests for this story, but did send written comments. Both agencies say they're required by law to recoup overpayments of disaster aid. They also said they warn recipients ahead of time about what could lead to a repayment, something homeowners acknowledge. Still, critics say the process has flaws.
It's not something that I experienced in my insurance life.
Congressman Tom MacArthur represents New Jersey's 3rd District. He says FEMA's response to Sandy has been, quote, checkered, and thinks the so-called clawbacks are unfair to homeowners. The Republican is sponsoring a bill that would bar FEMA from recouping any funds more than 3 years after they were awarded.
But this idea that they can do audits years later and just change their mind is what I tried to put an end to.
But homeowners who owe Sandy aid money back are still worried.
$35,174.34.
That's Fran Baranowitz. Her home took a beating during Sandy, but she was able to repair it and raise it 6 feet off the ground to protect it against the next storm. She received about $200,000 in government aid. Through discussions with the state, the retired medical secretary says she got her debt down to around $19,000. But that's still much more than Baranowitz says she can afford.
I'm a retired senior citizen. I'm on an income, a small income. I had some of a, you know, pension, but it's not that much. It's a lot of money. And we'll see what happens.
With the reform efforts on the horizon, homeowners are hopeful. But for now, they say the confusing letters, the long waits, the unanswered questions, it feels like Sandy all over again. For Here and Now, I'm Joe Hernandez.
Michigan is offering a total of $1 million in prize money to people who can come up with new ideas to keep invasive Asian carp from getting into Lake Michigan. And maybe it's just in time. In June, an 8-pound silver carp was pulled out of the Calumet River, having evaded electric barriers to get about 9 miles from Lake Michigan, too close for comfort for many. Because the fish can grow up to 100 pounds, can eat up all the food needed by native fish like trout and perch. In the Illinois River, fishermen are paid to pull carp out to thin the stocks. And since 2010, more than $388 million, mostly federal money, has gone to battling back the carp through those electric barriers and locks that flush water out as boats move through. And on Monday, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers released a report recommending similar methods and more at the Brandon Road Lock and Dam in Illinois, a crucial point between a river and the Great Lakes. And Michigan is now casting a net for more ideas. Molly Flanagan is Vice President of Policy for the Alliance for the Great Lakes, a nonprofit applauding Michigan's efforts. And Molly, it seems like great minds have been thinking about this for years.
The hope is that by putting money on the table, that will be enough of an incentive to get some other people with great minds and great ideas, potentially with new technologies that would stop Asian carp from moving any closer to the Great Lakes.
And tell us what's in place already. We know there, I mentioned the electric barriers. What are they?
So there are electric barriers, which essentially are a curtain of electricity in the water that are supposed to deter Asian carp from getting any closer to the Great Lakes. However, we know that they're not foolproof. Small fish can swim through the barrier sometimes, and also the barriers are prone to failure from time to time, so they're not always up and running perfectly.
Well, is it also like some other invasive species? Can they hitch rides on barges coming through?
They can hitch a ride with barges. They sort of get trapped in between the barge tows, and then they can get pulled through the barrier as well.
Well, you know, here's where there's, you know, real disagreement, because that Army Corps of Engineers report that I mentioned, it talks about just closing down, you know, locking down the locks and cutting Lake Michigan off from other travel. That would certainly keep out invasive species. But you know, people in Illinois, the Chicago area, they are very much against that because that would stop a lot of the flow of revenue through the lock. Now, the report was held up while they battled over this, the Corps ultimately deciding not to recommend closing the locks and cutting the lake off entirely. Your thoughts?
The most effective way to keep Asian carp out of the Great Lakes would be to restore the natural continental divide by putting some sort of physical barrier in the waterways. However, that is not what is being envisioned at Brandon Road Lock and Dam. It was one of the options on the table to look at closing that lock. But what's being recommended is a combination of technologies that include complex noise, water jets, electric barriers, technologies that would still allow waterborne traffic to move through the lock, but would hopefully keep Asian carp from moving through that lock.
And when you say return to the natural geography that was there, Lake Michigan was landlocked from the Mississippi River before a man-made shipping canal connected them. They were cut off, essentially.
Yes. The Chicago Area Waterway System is the only continuous connection between the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River Basin, which essentially makes it an invasive species superhighway that can allow aquatic invasive species to get into the Great Lakes and also to get out of the Great Lakes into other parts of the country. So this is how zebra mussels have gotten out of the Great Lakes and into other parts of the country.
We talked about this earlier this year in our lake series, that a lot of lakes across the country where people put their boats in, they have to be examined first to make sure they don't have those mussels on the bottom. The carp have not made it into Lake Michigan. Now, there's a lot of reasons. There are the electrical barriers that have been put up. But some researchers note that the fish aren't really moving forward, that maybe there's something they like in the water where they are. The U.S. Geological Survey is studying whether there might be a chemical in the water, some kind of natural bacteria. that triggers a stress gene, and so the fish don't want to move forward. Is it worth letting nature take its course?
I think that we have already not allowed nature to take its course by introducing Asian carp into waterways in the United States. They're not a natural fish anywhere in the United States. And so I think it makes a lot of sense that the state of Michigan, the federal government, Congress are looking at options to make sure Asian carp don't advance any closer to the Great Lakes.
Paint the picture if the carp do get in the lake.
Invasive carp are already in a number of places in the country. And where they exist, you have seen decimation of native fish species. In some places, Asian carp make up 90% of the biomass in rivers where they are established. And so keeping Asian carp out of the Great Lakes is really critical to protecting our fishing and recreational opportunities in the region.
Well, so Michigan has this contest. But meantime, let's say they come up with a great idea. The Trump administration 2018 budget plan would cut $300 million from funding for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, money that was supposed to go to implementing ideas for keeping the carp out.
Yes. Luckily, it looks like our Great Lakes champions in Congress aren't going to stand for that and are working to make sure that that $300 million is included in the federal year 2018 budget.
Molly Flanagan, Vice President of Policy for the Alliance for the Great Lakes, on the new contest being offered by Michigan, a $1 million prize to come up with a new idea to keep the invasive Asian carp out of Lake Michigan. We'll link you at herenow.org. Molly, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, math is meeting politics this week as a group of mathematicians takes on the issue of gerrymandering. That's the practice of setting up electoral districts to favor a particular political party or group. The Metric, Geometry, and Gerrymandering group is hosting the first of a series of workshops devoted to making our electoral process more fair. Reporter Carol Zoll has more.
When Tufts University mathematician Mira Bernstein and her colleagues announced they'd be holding a public workshop on the geometry of voting districts, they didn't expect a big response.
We thought, we'll get, 30 people together and they'll talk math and it'll be a small gathering. And then we got just thousands of responses right away.
It turns out many people are hungry to know all about gerrymandering, the art of drawing voting districts to give an unfair advantage to one political party over another.
And usually that's accomplished by two methods. One's called packing and the other's called cracking.
Stephen Ansoliba here is presenting at this week's workshop. He's a professor of government at Harvard who studies elections and voting. Here's his definition of cracking.
So if I want to dilute somebody's voting strength, I could take a community and divide it in half and put each of those halves into districts that are dominated by some other groups.
Packing, on the other hand, is when legislators draw maps to concentrate like-minded voters into the same district to reduce the impact their votes could have had in other districts. These tactics to manipulate borders of voting districts often result in districts with very strange shapes. So, an oddly shaped district can give rise to suspicions of gerrymandering. And that's where the math connection comes in. One way to determine whether a voting district has been manipulated like this is to ask whether the district is what's called compact. Again, Mira Bernstein.
Most states require their legislative districts to be compact without specifying exactly what that means. And most people have an intuitive idea that compact means some kind of nice shape, maybe a circle, maybe a square, not something that looks like an octopus.
In other words, if a district has been manipulated and has tentacles like an octopus, it isn't compact. Bernstein and her colleagues think they can help better define compactness mathematically, which could lead to a better legal standard. But beyond helping with this technical question, they're also hoping to pull more people into the conversation about improving our voting system. Lawrence Lessig is a Harvard law professor and a critic of the current system of redistricting.
So this is a system that basically silences close to 90 million Americans in the political process because their vote just can't matter to determining who the congressman will be.
Lessig says that technology is making gerrymandering worse.
Big data, technology, has radically improved the efficiency by which the politicians are now able to draw and select these districts.
Mathematician Mira Bernstein agrees.
There are organizations both on the left and on the right that collect, you know, internet data on people. And for almost every voter, they have a model for how that person will vote. And so what we need is people who know how to use the technology to sort of rise up and counteract that.
This week's Geometry of Redistricting workshop sessions not only cover mathematical concepts like compactness, but also include lectures on legal issues and training on how to be an expert witness in court to challenge gerrymandering. Several of the sessions focus on using GIS, or geographic information software, to redraw maps of voting districts.
There's a great app that I love called Dave's Redistricting App, where anybody can draw their own districts.
Harvard's Stephen Ansaliba here says this kind of software can make the redistricting process much more transparent.
In Virginia, somebody realized through this public mapping process that they could find another minority district in the state of Virginia. And that ultimately led to the creation of that district.
That's exactly the kind of public engagement the Metric Geometry and Gerrymandering Group is trying to encourage. In the coming months, they'll be holding 4 more workshops throughout the U.S. as they try to build a community of people who want to end gerrymandering. And they're looking ahead to 2020, when the next U.S. Census shows shifts in growth in population and triggers redistricting all over the country. For Here and Now, I'm Carol Zoll.
And if you're tired of making up long passwords with ampersands and percent signs, here's some good news. The National Institute of Standards and Technology, part of the Commerce Department, has issued new guidance on what makes a good password for, say, your online bank account. And that advice does not include many of the things that we've been told to do in the past. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy. This is music to my ears, by the way, because passwords are really troublesome for me.
Yeah, me too. And everybody that's listening, probably. Yeah. Now, we're going to get to the new guidelines. But first, where did these old guidelines about special characters and uppercase letters come from?
So a guy named Bill Burr worked for this National Institutes of Standards and Technology. In 2003, he came up with a bulletin that said the best passwords were awkward words with obscure characters and capitals and numbers, and that changing passwords regularly was also important. And that's the basis upon which companies that use passwords have been telling people to create their passwords. And it turns out that's not exactly true.
Those requirements don't actually help improve security?
Yeah, so the issue is passwords are now broken by computers, right? They try these algorithms and they try variations on things. And what the new studies have showed is that these rules have done little for security. They have a relatively negative impact on your actual usability because people forget them all the time and have to change them. And that people often use little transformations when they change passwords. Don't tell anyone, I'm one of those people. You know, like you change the number 1 to a number 2, or you change an O to a 0 or an S to a dollar sign.
Well, in fairness, no password hacker could ever figure that out, right?
Well, that's the thing. That hackers have figured this out a long time ago, and so they can figure it out very quickly, and most people forget the changes they've made, so they keep on making other changes that hackers can find out as easily.
So what are we supposed to do now? What are the most secure kinds of passwords?
So the new guidance is that easy to remember but long phrases make more sense than crazy characters. So, for instance, if a password that is a normal word, say 11 characters, but it's got capitals and it's got numbers and it's got ampersands and dollar signs, would take a hacker, a machine doing this about 3 days to crack. But if you used a 25-character sentence, no spaces in it, but just letters, all lowercase, that same password would take 550 years to crack because each letter is one of 26 options and you've multiplied 25 by 26 and got all those options. And so that is why those 2003 rules don't work as well as the new guidelines. So a password that is a phrase with no spaces and lots of characters.
25 characters in a password?
Right. But remember, so two things. One is letters are better than numbers because you have more options, right?
Right.
The hacker has to go through 26 options of every letter, but it could be a sentence that you like. I enjoy eating turkey sandwiches. That's the kind of thing that's 26 times the number of letters in that thing. So the point is make it easy to remember. do something, talk about something that you actually like talking about and use that as your password.
And don't use the turkey sandwiches one now, Ali, because now listeners all know it.
Yeah, that's right.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thanks as always.
All right. Bye.
It's Here and Now. Actor William H. Macy has received his fourth consecutive Emmy nomination for Outstanding Lead Actor in a Comedy Series for Showtime's Shameless. He's also won two Screen Actors Guild awards for his role in the show. In Shameless, Macy stars as Frank Gallagher, whose drinking impacts not just his life, but the lives of his grown children.
We make mistakes, have faults. Lips drinking his breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Ian's a bipolar queer. Deb's 15 with a baby on her hip.
I spoke with William H. Macy last November as Shameless was in the middle of its seventh season. And let me ask you this, because this show is not about a president. It's not about a terrorist attack. It doesn't have any dragons in it. Why do you think so many people have come back to it for seven seasons? Now, it's a difficult topic to take, really.
It is. I think people like it because at the end of the day, it's about this family. And they get each other's back, as they say on the street. And I think that's very compelling. It's the Gallagher family is really one paycheck away from being homeless. They really live on the edges, but they're really great kids. It was beautifully cast in the beginning. And I play the ne'er-do-well – not ne'er-do-well. I play the reprobate father. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict, and I'm just the bane of their existence. And it's this weird love-hate relationship. And what I hear from a lot of people that watch the show is, oh, my God, there's a Frank Gallagher in my family too. Mm. My father was like that. Boy, could I tell you stories. So it just rings the bell of truth for so many people.
Well, what is it about that character, Frank, that has brought you back to it year after year now?
Oh, my Lord, I've got the best character on television. He is, well, he's shameless. At the beginning of the thing, he was a drinking alcoholic and drug addict. And it was very interesting to do scene after scene after scene in some form of inebriation. And they say, how can you tell if an alcoholic is lying to you or a drug addict is lying to you? Well, his lips are moving. Mm-hmm. And that was Frank. He was just a wheeler and a dealer, and determined to never work a day in his life and to sponge off of his family. And when he would get drunk, he would just do the most awful things. And they throw him out of the house all the time. And he keeps coming back. And over the years, Frank's character has become more and more complex. This past season, it came out that Frank did 3 years of college and dropped out when he met Monica, his wife, the mother of the children. And they started getting high together, and they've stayed high for the last, what, 30 years. And one episode, he sits down and he starts playing the piano. And everyone says, who knew Frank could play the piano? So it's a very multifaceted character. He's very smart, and he's funny, and he's quick-witted, and he's pretty knowledgeable. And then you combine that with the fact that he's loaded most of the time.
Well, and how is it to play somebody who is drunk when I assume you're sober when you're doing it?
To a certain extent, it's a parlor trick. The danger in it is that you walk away from a scene saying, well, that was a great drunk I just did. And then you remember, oh, I forgot to act the scene. I guess inebriation is not an unknown quality to me. And there are tricks that you can do. And well, it's great fun. And I would sort of, over the past 7 years, I would talk to myself about, well, how loaded is he? You know, And I would judge the scene that way.
Now, this show is set in Chicago. We read that when John Wells, the showrunner, first pitched it, he got suggestions that it take place somewhere rural, maybe in a trailer park in the South or something like that. Why do you think Chicago is such a good place for this show? Because it is really a part of the show, the city.
It really is. It's the center of the country. It's a hard-working town. It's I think it's the center of the country on many levels, politically, culturally. It's right smack in the middle. It's not L.A. and it's not New York. John has said that Had we done this in the South and put a Southern accent on these people, you would have characterized them and perhaps discarded them or dismissed what they were going through as just a bunch of hicks. And by setting it in Chicago, it's in a working-class neighborhood. It just has more resonance somehow.
You spent some time in your career in Chicago doing live performance,
Yeah. It's very sweet. I started my career there. Dave Mamet was my mentor from college, and he wrote my good buddy Stephen Schachter and myself. We were here in Los Angeles trying to do some theater after college, and he said, no, I just did this play, Sexual Perversity, in Chicago. It's a big hit. Come out here. And it was inconvenient. I just found a girlfriend and bought a motorcycle, but I had to get rid of both. And I moved to Chicago, and I lived there for 10 years. And after about 2 years, we put a down payment on a warehouse and built a theater.
Huh.
And we were off to the races. The first play we ever did was American Buffalo. Hmm. And the first three plays we did were sold-out hits. So we kind of own that town.
Do you miss live performance?
I do. It's hard. I did a play about 3 or 4 years ago, and it's a lot of work, man. It's a lot of work. I think for a civilian, you'd think, well, you work from 8 to 10 in the evening. That's not a full job, but it is. That's all you can do all day.
Hmm. You've also taught acting, and you and Dave Mamet founded the Atlantic Acting School. What do you tell young actors? What's the one thing that you want them to take away?
Well, I stopped teaching at a point, and just to be blunt, I started to listen to some of the crap I was saying, and I just thought, oh, my God, I can't do this anymore. And I look back on all the teaching I did, and it is my fond hope that I didn't hurt anybody. I'm not sure I taught anyone anything.
What was the crap you were saying?
Oh, you know, all this technique stuff. And what I was starting to see was that what a lot of actors do is they use technique or some theory instead of acting. It's always been a conundrum in this business that you can have somebody walk onto a film set or a stage with no training and be brilliant, and then you get somebody who's been studying it his or her whole life, and they're not very good. The vast majority of what you need comes from God. You got the talent or you don't have the talent. And the other stuff, you can learn pretty quickly. And interestingly, my daughter is going into the business. She's going to LACSA, which is the Performing Arts High School here. And so I, of course, have been talking to her about acting. And I finally synthesized what you need to do to one sentence. And I said, okay, at the end of the day, this is what it's got to be. It's got to sound like you're making everything up and you've never said it before.
Hmm.
The end.
You mentioned your daughter. I have to point out that you're also married to Felicity Huffman, the actress, and unlike almost every celebrity couple we can think of, you guys are still married 19 years later with two kids. How does that work? How do you make that work in Hollywood in a way that so many others haven't?
Oh, I don't think it's just in Hollywood. I think it's hard to be married. The only thing I can say is marry Felicity Huffman and everything will work out well. I just got lucky, man. There's nothing more than that. I just got lucky. We adore each other and we both love this business, and it's the foundation of so much of what we do together. And she wants nothing but success for me and me back at her. I don't think we've been jealous of each other at all, ever. It just works really well. I'm a lucky guy.
Is there another William Macy that you're distinguishing yourself from with the H, or why have you always had the H?
Bill Macy. Remember Maude, the TV show?
Yeah.
Maude? He played her husband, and he was in a wonderful movie called The Late Show. Terrific actor. I finally met him. And anyway, he got Bill Macy, so I, for a while, was W.H. Macy, but I noticed that when I went to an audition, people would skip my name because they'd see W.H. and they didn't want to say W.H., so they'd skip me. And so I sort of unilaterally took on William H. Macy, and the union never said I couldn't do it. So my dad liked that because I'm a junior.
Hmm. Well, William H. Macy, Emmy-nominated star of Showtime's Shameless, thank you so much for joining us. Great having you.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Concerns about violence did not stop people from lining up to vote in Kenya today. After the 2007 election, more than 1,000 people died in protests. 2013 was peaceful, but the sitting president then, Kenyatta, won by just a slim margin, and his challenger then, Raila Odinga, challenged that vote and lost. Today, the two men face off again, and in the run-up to this vote, a top election official in Kenya was murdered. Officials say he was also tortured. NPR's East Africa correspondent Eder Peralta joins us from a polling station near Nairobi. Eder, what are you seeing there, given this concern, a murder leading up to this election? How do people seem at the polling places?
I mean, you can probably hear it, right? It is calm. It is orderly. I've seen lots of celebration. I think that both sides are very confident of a victory. And it seems like the electronic voting system is working the way it was designed. Now, I did speak to a member of parliament who said, look, this is voting. Kenya has never had problems with voting. They've had problems with counting. So, you know, the voting has gone really well. We'll see about the counting.
Right. Well, President Kenyatta called today for Kenyans to respect the result of the vote, to have dinner with each other, to respect each other. His challenger is former Prime Minister Raila Odinga. They used to share power, but now Odinga leads the opposition, longtime rivals. What do they represent to the voters?
I mean, this is being seen as the election that ends a feud that began at independence here in Kenya. So Uhuru Kenyatta is the son of the first president of Kenya. Raila Odinga is the son of the first vice president of Kenya. And back in the 60s, right after independence, Raila's father and Uhuru's father had a falling out. And that basically set the table for the politics we see today in Kenya, which is a very tribal politics. People vote with their tribe, and they've done so since independence, in large part because of this rift. So I think there's two ways to see this election. Raila Odinga has said this is his last time that he's going to run for president. This is also his fourth time. And so I think voters are seeing it as an end to this old rivalry, and analysts are seeing it as the potential end to tribal politics in Kenya, which is, you know, I spoke to one analyst who said he was looking forward to this election being over, and he was really looking forward to the next election.
Well, as you said, it's presumed, though, that this one will be along sort of ethnic lines. President Kenyatta, seen as the candidate of the Kikuyu people,
Kikuyu.
Odinga associated with the Luo?
That's right. So, I mean, and the Kikuyu people have, ruled this country since the very beginning. As I said, Jomo Kenyatta was a Kikuyu. And the Luos, which is one of the biggest tribes in Kenya, have always struggled to be in power. And Raila is this symbol of this large population of people who have always wanted the presidency.
And we understand Kenyatta is also campaigning on a record of big infrastructure projects, many of them backed by China, interesting, whereas Odinga is campaigning against corruption. Is that a fair assessment?
It is. Basically, in a lot of ways, it feels like an American campaign. Raila Odinga is campaigning on change. But more importantly, perhaps, he's campaigning on two huge issues here in Kenya, which is jobs. About 40% of Kenyans do not have jobs. And the second one is the high cost of living. So Kenyans have seen inflation just skyrocket, and many of them cannot afford very simple things like sugar. So that is what Raila Odinga is betting on, that Kenyans will turn their backs on this brand new train that was built from Mombasa to Nairobi, a big infrastructure project. It's showy, but Raila Odinga is betting that Kenyans will vote with their wallet. And a lot of them are having a really tough time right now.
Well, we know that former Secretary of State John Kerry is one of the thousands of observers there. There are high-ranking observers from around the world. Just remind us, very briefly, of course we care about democratic elections, But why is what happens in Kenya important?
It's the powerhouse of East Africa. I mean, if Kenya sneezes, you know, a lot of the continent gets a cold. It is a very much a functioning democracy and a free society where people are able to talk against their government.
And I'm sure the U.S. has an eye on Kenya as it builds big infrastructure projects with China. NPR East Africa correspondent Ader Peralta. They're at a polling station near Nairobi, Kenya, as Kenyans vote today. Ader, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.